At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston coming at you in our new home of 1 p.m. Eastern time. A new start time, 2 hours earlier. Some of you probably logging in at the former time realizing, hey, the show is already here in my podcast feed. Hello, Brandon. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? I'm reading a lot of things this afternoon.
Yes, we've got documents. We've got lots of documents. Today will be a show full of lawsuits, turnstile counts, and documentaries. Notes on the making of the Mr. McMahon series that we have been reporting on over this last week since we got the announcement of Mr. McMahon coming to Netflix at the end of September. But today we are going to be kicking things off with a lawsuit that was just filed on Friday in Pennsylvania. And we have got Kevin Kelly, real name Kevin Foote, and the Tate twins, Brandon and Brent, that have filed a class action complaint against All Elite Wrestling, Tony Khan, and Ian Riccoboni in the Court of Common Pleas of Philadelphia County. This is a 40-some-odd page complaint that has been filed that we have gone through, that we have tried to make the best sense out of, and we will be discussing this case right off the bat, something that had at least been hinted at by Kevin Kelly that he would be seeking legal remedies after his exit from AEW earlier this year. And what we did not know was that the Tate twins would be involved in this, and they were cut by the company earlier this year, which was kind of a controversy in and of itself of the nature of why they were cut. They were told, allegedly told, it was due to budget cuts. And then we heard Tony Khan both on the call before the Supercard of Honor show and during the post show press conference, citing that they had missed several events. And this was, you know, a discussion point over that WrestleMania weekend when that event was taking place, along with several other cuts, one of which was the Anthony Henry cut, which was then reversed.
Yeah, the Tate twins being a part of litigation against AEW is a surprise to me, at least. The bigger surprise, I guess, in the more newsworthy thing, I think, coming out of this is as we read this, there's an argument being made by the plaintiffs here against the notion that AEW wrestlers and talent, in the case of Kevin Kelly, are independent contractors, and makes an argument that talent and wrestlers are employees and they are being misclassified. They're seeking the payment that they're not getting because their contracts were terminated, royalties and other things. We have not been able to find this yet in the case search for the Unified Judicial System of Pennsylvania. This is in state court. I'm kind of surprised that this was not in federal court, but it is in state court in Pennsylvania. We got a copy of the complaint from Stephen P. New, who is the main lawyer representing these plaintiffs here. And we might show parts of it on the screen here. I've gone through the trouble of redacting everyone's contact information, so have no fear. We will not be exposing anybody's address or telephone number here. It's a complaint that we have, and we've read it over, and we'll go through some detail of it.
Yes. So this was filed on Friday. And again, we had the complaint sent to us. They are seeking an excess of $50,000. The defendants have 20 days to respond to this case after being served. And it outlines the agreements that Kevin Kelly had from June 12th of 2023, which coincided with the launch of collision and then was terminated on March 6th of this year. The Tate signed an agreement with AEW last August and were terminated on April 1st, reportedly due to budget cuts. And then later Khan made his comments, which we will play after this. It goes over kind of the structure of AEW and ROH, the number of talents listed. And this is where they argue over whether AEW has misclassified its performers as independent contractors and claims that the AEW contracts prohibit talents from challenging the validity, legality, or enforceability of the agreement and are unreasonably favorable to AEW, where the cost for a talent to seek retribution in arbitration is, it precludes the plaintiffs from seeking resolution. So not unlike the contract makeup we see now in the UFC, where arbitration is the method for these talents to go through if they have an issue with the company. There was also this line that, quote, do you want to stop there if you want to
go ahead.
Well, there was this interesting line that AEW limits the statements that can be made by talent and wrestlers and prohibits any criticism, warranted or not, of AEW or other talent or wrestlers. Which I found to be just an interesting line that feels like that is like language straight from, you would assume, the AEW contracts, that you actually cannot say anything negative about the company.
Yeah, so there's a lot that's redacted too in this copy of the complaint that we have, which is presumably references to the contracts for the Tate twins and for Kevin Kelly. So there's lots of redactions in this, just to be clear. There are like entire pages that are redacted out. I don't know what that's about necessarily, other than maybe that this is proprietary information, or you know, AEW would have some sort
of your two least favorite words, trade secrets,
proprietary information. AEW might fight that. But yeah, there's some references there to what's referred to as a playbook, explaining how you can't say anything negative, justified or not, about AEW or other talent.
So just going on, and this kind of this first section is largely contained to the argument of the labeling of employee independent contractors, and they're seeking a declaration that they and all others since October 2019, when Dynamite launched, are employees of AEW, and they're seeking injunctive relief and damages that they suffered as a result of the misclassification, with Kevin Foote and the Tates claiming wrongful termination and not being paid certain monies, including royalties, as well as not being reimbursed for travel expenses. So let's kind of digest that part first, because that is a very significant portion of this case beyond what Kevin Kelly is alleging against the company and Ian Riccaboni. It's also worth noting that this is not the first time that Stephen New has attempted to seek out a whether there's a misclassification of a performer. If you remember back in 2021, when Ring of Honor was under the Sinclair ownership, that he represented Kelly Klein, who filed a lawsuit against the company and also was claiming she was misclassified as a independent contractor, and that was a part of that lawsuit as well. So not the first time he has made this attempt.
Yeah, and I should mention too, so we've reached out to AEW about this, haven't heard back yet, but we did ask Stephen New why this case, for one thing, doesn't appear in the public court system, and he suggested because of the sensitive nature of the allegations, because we have filed a motion to place the exhibits under seal, that might explain why it's not in the system. And I asked him too why this is in Pennsylvania state court as opposed to federal court. My assumption would be that you have the Tate twins who live in Tennessee. You have Kevin Kelly, who I believe lives in Pennsylvania. Ian Riccaboni lives in Pennsylvania. AEW is a Delaware corporation. Its headquarters are in Florida. But he said there is not diversity of jurisdiction. Ian Riccaboni is a resident of Pennsylvania, and so is Kevin Foote, who's Kevin Kelly. He said Tony Khan's defamatory remarks were made in Philadelphia, thus venue is appropriate there as well. And the remarks, some of those remarks are at a press conference that we were both at, and I think you asked a relevant question to this case.
Well, let's hear. This was, again, days after Tony Khan had noted why the boys, the Tates, had been cut by Ring of Honor. And if you remember, prior to that Supercard of Honor show, the Tates had gone online and kind of given their side of things and posted several text messages, and were basically, it came down to them sort of a miscommunication issue and being sent to a different location to fly out of Tennessee. So here is my question.
This week you talked about some of the cuts, and today the Tate twins put out their rebuttal about some communication error when it came to the show that they missed. I don't know if you have had a chance to see, but they are citing that there was a miscommunication where they were awaiting confirmation on their travel for Ottawa, and that was the reason they did not make it to that show in Ottawa.
I have not seen their exact statement. After the show, I heard a little bit of this as I was coming back. I stand by what I said. And also, I've only owned ROH for 2 years. There's a long history of ROH, and it was my call to bring them back. I like their presentation with Dalton, and I like them both personally. I've had a lot of good experiences with them. And, you know, I would be open to working with them again in the future. But there have been times where they came and have done great things for us. We did the House Rules tour, and they were drive-in tour in the South, and I loved having them. And they've been to a lot of the Saturdays, but there have been some times for my era of ROH, and I've been told from the company I inherited other times in the past. And I'm just going off my experiences. As for that, I did talk about that and confirm. I think there's two sides to that story, but I appreciate you asking about it. I know yesterday they said stay tuned, so I stayed tuned, and then I heard, and I'm not moved. But thank you.
Not moved at the time. And this also follows the pre-show media call, and this came from Andrew Thompson's recap of it. When WrestleNomics' Brandon Thurston asked about the 10 talent releases on April 1st, Khan said he has nothing against any of the individuals that were cut. He explained that he spent more money than he could expected to this year, adding that the entrance songs for Eddie Kingston and Mark Briscoe sum up what would be a year's salary for some wrestlers. Khan said he'd welcome any of the released talent back under the right circumstances, including the boys.
Yes. So then what else is in this contract? There's defamation being alleged. It goes through the allegations from Kevin Kelly towards Ian Riccoboni about a post that Kevin Kelly had made, I believe, on Facebook about the film The Sound of Freedom. And Ian Riccoboni responded to that on a Discord channel, referring to it as a QAnon movie. And that's
yes.
This complaint is arguing against the notion that there is a connection between QAnon and the Sound of Freedom.
Yeah, so this really gets into the weeds, and I think it's going to be a difficult one to, like, in order to prove defamation, it is a pretty high bar you have to reach. Riccoboni had posted on the Discord channel, quote, also, had no idea he was going to promote QAnon movies, or else I might have made a different suggestion. I suppose that his name was always in the mix, but that QAnon stuff breaks my heart a little bit, end quote. They do outline in the complaint, acknowledging that the movie has been associated with QAnon on in social media, but the association between the movie and QAnon is unproven and false, and went on to state that Kelly tried to contact Ian Riccoboni to resolve the issue, but did not receive a response, claimed that the statement that Foot was promoting QAnon is unproven and false. Riccoboni did not remove the post or otherwise clarify it to disassociate Foot from QAnon. And that led to Kevin Foot, making a complaint to AEW regarding the post, said that AEW began to take adverse actions regarding his entities, including placing Tony Schiavone as the play-by-play commentator on Collision beginning in November, where Kevin Kelly became the third man on the booth. And then he was finally told that Riccoboni was disciplined, but they would not share the details of such discipline, and said that this led to Kevin Kelly's mental health being affected, as well as his marital relationship, and believing that, you know, he has, you know, suffered you know, damages to his reputation, to business opportunities, and then he was let go on March the 6th of this year.
Yeah, and he's denying in here that he has any association with QAnon. He never has and never will. And he's saying here, we'll read this part, the implied association with QAnon subjects plaintiff Foot, who's Kevin Kelly, to ridicule, embarrassment, humiliation, and is detrimental to his personal and professional relationships. The complaint goes on to mention how Kevin Kelly says he had an opportunity to do commentary for the New Japan Altogether show, and he believes that AEW prevented that from happening.
Which would have been 2 months after his contract was up with AEW. So it would have been he's alleging that AEW blocked that from happening.
And he's saying that he was terminated on March 6th. There's not a mention here, I guess, in the complaint about the tweet that he made, sort of, you know, shooting back at Ian Riccoboni, where he said on March 2nd, so some 4 days before he was terminated, when you go out of your way to intentionally mischaracterize my awareness of the global horrors of child trafficking to a fringe conspiracy theory that everyone knows is bullshit in order to hurt my career and standing in the industry, that is at the very least, is libelous. And there's other tweets, that were associated with that, that day of Twitter.
He had also stated on, I think it was Eric Bischoff's show, that he had some interaction with an AEW employee over the phone that he acknowledged may have been tense, I guess, whatever his description of it was. So, I mean, there was that aspect to this as well. I mean, when you it's going to be very difficult because you are like they acknowledge here in the suit. And I think anyone that has seen like the Sound of Freedom, like the director has denied that it's a QAnon endorsed film or that this was aimed toward that audience. At the same time, like that was, I mean, it was very much considered a QAnon adjacent movie. And who is to determine what is or is not a movie that's promoting a specific movement? It becomes very difficult to prove or unprove that.
Yes, this isn't exactly a well-organized official organization, QAnon. But I think we should go through what makes an independent contractor and an employee different from one another, which is, I think the most powerful thing that's happening here. First, you know, like all lawsuits, there's a good chance this will just be settled and will go away at some point. But there's a real vulnerability in AEW's case, as well as WWE's case, around this issue where wrestlers have for decades been classified as independent contractors, while there's a strong argument that they are misclassified and are really functioning as employees. And you know, I was just going through this as my Labor Day activity the other day, and I found that the Department of Labor has defined a economic reality test to determine whether or not a given worker is an employee or an independent contractor. So I think we should just briefly go through this, and we can ask ourselves whether this sounds, in the case of a WWE wrestler, an AEW wrestler, whether this sounds more like an independent contractor or an employee. And it says, you know, in order to determine economic dependence, multiple factors, there are six factors here that they go through. The opportunity for profit or loss, depending on managerial skill. That sounds abstruse. Number two, investments by the worker and the potential employer. The factor considers whether any investments by a worker are capital or entrepreneurial in nature. I guess I would think of this as being, you know, in the sense in which, you know, wrestlers train themselves and invest in themselves. The potential employer imposes unilaterally on the worker, for example, are not evidence of capital or entrepreneurial investment and indicate employee status. The degree of permanence of the work relationship. Obviously, wrestlers have a long-term contract. That sounds like a degree of permanence, right? The nature and degree of control. And this complaint specifically goes over how there are all these instructions and rules that AEW wrestlers have to follow, including in the case of Kevin Kelly, there's mentioning of the fact that he is given, you know, statements to say in commentary while he's doing commentary on a television show. As you know, people listening are probably well know that commentators are routinely directed by people in the back, including Tony Khan or Vince McMahon or Paul Levesque. So there's a lot of control there. The extent,
except Taz, I don't think anyone is telling Taz what to do.
No, certainly not. But I digress. The extent to which the work is performed as is an integral part of the potential employer's business. I would say wrestlers are an integral part of wrestling companies such as AEW, wouldn't you? And the skill and initiative, this factor considers whether the worker uses specialized skills to perform the work and whether those skills contribute to business-like initiative. This factor indicates employee status where the worker does not use specialized skills in performing the work or the worker is dependent on training from the potential employer to perform the work, where the worker brings specialized skills to the work relationship. The fact is not itself indicative of independent contractor status, but because both employees and independent contractors may be skilled workers, it is the worker's use of those specialized skills in connection with business-like initiative that indicates the worker is an independent contractor. So that sounds pretty technical and difficult to me. But the number of control factors is the thing that often gets confused. That is the answer to the question, is how much control does AEW or WWE have over wrestlers? It's not a matter of exclusive, being under an exclusive contract, which may be part of it, but it's the notion of control, that AEW may have over its wrestlers that determines whether a worker is an independent contractor or an employee. And we know that some AEW wrestlers, yes, they do have dual status, including Chris Jericho has been public about that. Others, I believe CM Punk had dual status, and that may have been a main issue in why he had to be fired. But the vast majority, the run of the mill AEW talent is not in dual status, is not in an employee status. So, and part of what they're seeking here, plaintiffs, is they want basically the value of all of their payroll taxes that they did not receive. As you know, independent contractors, that's one of the big issues. If you're an independent contractor, you don't get the contribution that is required of employers to your federal and state and Medicare taxes, the FICA taxes. You have to basically pay double taxes because you are classified as an independent contractor, when in all likelihood you should be rightly classified as an employee.
And it would be interesting as well to get into their heads as well about any observations of what the UFC has gone through and extrapolating that over to professional wrestling, where I think you would look at just the levels of control are inherently more, are increased that much more in the pro wrestling space specific to WWE and to AEW than a UFC fighter, for instance, when it comes to just the differences between them.
Yeah, and we talked about before, you know, I'm sure the people in WWE and AEW are watching that antitrust case and, you know, and seeing how that might apply to their business. Independent contractor is probably something that made sense in the territorial days, and is carried over, because it's beneficial to businesses and the workers aren't well organized and the workers are highly self-interested and highly competitive. And this has never been resolved, and it's just sitting there as a vulnerability. It's an interesting discussion to have about the notion that AEW decided to carry that over. That's just cheaper. And until there's a legal precedent or a legal cause for them to do otherwise, I suppose, you know, they're going to do this as well. Although they have, you know, made some of the wrestlers employees.
And when we had, Brad Bellucci and the author on a number of months ago in his book, this was kind of brought up with the controller that they had that came on in the mid-80s to kind of get their book. First of all, take this from a cash business to updating it to just modern standards at the time in the mid-80s. And one of the issues brought up was the independent contractor issue. And in essence, I'd encourage people to read the specific chapter in his book. But basically, it was an issue of like, it would be so costly to make that shift, and it was not something that they were going to tackle at that time, but it was at least an area of concern that these may be independent contractors that are being misclassified. But over the years, it's not been an issue that has been pushed in, like, it pops up every now and then as a subject, but really doesn't get to a point where it's addressed in any meaningful way.
Okay. And it's been brought to my attention here as we're on the air. We do have a public court, we do have public evidence that this, you know, that this lawsuit is happening. It's been titled as Foot et al. Versus All Elite Wrestling et al. I won't scroll down because then we start to see people's addresses here, but we do have through the Philadelphia courts civil docket access, we do have records of this that are public.
We don't want to send anyone to the Tate's front door knocking on it. Certainly for not answers. Yeah, I mean, this is, it's interesting that they are kind of combining all of this, because it is some, you know, it's defamation, it's independent contractors, like it's just this whole hodgepodge of things that are alleged against the defendants that they are trying to cover all in one lawsuit itself. They are seeking a jury trial for this and seeking in excess of $50,000. So whatever, you know, a judge could deem out of that is the outcome. I mean, if you are, yeah, it will be interesting to see if Tony Khan is asked about this in any form tomorrow when he is doing his media call ahead of All Out. But I would imagine it would be we're not going to get into legal things.
Probably. Again, we've reached out to AEW and I haven't heard back. But yeah, it would be these what's the standby comment? These allegations are without merit and I tend to vigorously defend myself against them. That's always a good standby if they need a comment.
Is Tony Khan still not moved? That would be the question from the suit. Any other just final thoughts on this? I mean, it's, you know, by the way they have presented this, it's that this could apply to all AEW performers as well. Like there would be an incentive if you are an AEW performer that you will have a vested interest in if this makes its way to, I mean, often these suits do not make it to a trial, but one that I think you would at least be watching. If you're an AEW talent, that this could have, this is at least going to raise some questions that could at least put AEW in a position where they would have to address the status of its performers.
Yeah. But the thing I would highlight is that they're trying to create a class. They're trying to create this and make this a class action lawsuit, which is probably, you know, the scariest thing that they can do here. In addition, they have all these other claims, but to really try to maybe leverage AEW into whatever it might be settling, or I'm sure that they will have the plaintiffs will have the outward appearance of wanting to take this to trial. But this is where, you know, they're going after that vulnerability that you've got, you know, maybe over 100 workers here who are potentially misclassified as independent contractors when they are rightly being treated as employees.
Let's take a super chat here from Bruce Lohr. Thank you, Bruce. Can the credulity of independent contractor status be separated from the defamation in this suit structure and aims? The former seems more viable and precedent setting than the latter. So essentially what we were just discussing, like this is covering several big topics here. And I guess obviously from the defendant side or from the plaintiff side, they want all of this contained into this one suit that they are trying to bear out. And I guess tie it in some ways that, you know, as independent contractors, maybe like a Kevin Kelly would have been given more of a transparent due process if he had been an employee and there was a better transparency of this disciplinary measure that he feels Ian Riccaboni violated by posting this online, and that he did not have rights as his contract as an independent contractor displayed.
One thing, I don't know if this is a response to the question at all from Bruce, but one thing we might see if our experience in covering the Grant case against WWE is any indication is that there's discussion here about arbitration, and it certainly sounds like these contracts have arbitration clauses. So if there is a dispute, that there should not be a lawsuit about it. It should go to arbitration, which is a subject as well in the UFC lawsuit, the antitrust lawsuit there, right? And they're making a case here to say that, you know, this shouldn't go to arbitration for all these reasons, including that arbitration is very expensive and they have no means to get discovery in arbitration. It's very expensive for them to do arbitration. Arbitration will be in Florida. They live in Tennessee. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how well these arguments are gonna hold up or be strong. But maybe something we would see is a motion to compel this case to arbitration so that it does not continue in public court from AEW is what I'm saying.
And Bruce stating in there that he is not a lawyer in an abbreviated form. So get your mind out of the gutter if you were trying to figure out what that was. So there you go, everyone. We will obviously be following the suit again. It just came to everyone's. It was the Wrestling News that broke this earlier this morning. So the complaint is now public, so you can seek it out for yourself. It's about 44 pages. Maybe like 10 of them are redacted. But
well, I don't know if you'll be able to see it for yourself without paying like $10. I have to look into this more. But yeah,
that's the cost. Us to being in the game, folks. Dollars to play. That's how you get into all the legal wranglings in the professional wrestling space.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, it's your chance to travel back to November 2004 as Wei Ting and I review WWE Raw featuring Trish Stratus and Lita headlining the show. Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson are going to be covering New Japan's Destruction in Kobe event, and MCU later tackles Agatha All Along. All of that, plus Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course weekly, and ad-free versions of Rewind to Raw and Dynamite. $6 a month unlocks it all at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Someone who is, of course, this has now become your WrestleMania moment every year, and that is turnstile count time. And that is a term that Brandon, I am going to give credit for introducing into the wrestling lexicon last year when all in took place at Wembley Stadium. And we do have the number for this past year's All in London event, the return to Wembley Stadium, which we should remind folks that we have not gotten a specific number out of AEW like we did last year. Tony Khan has stated on the record in excess of 50,000. WrestleTix had pegged it at over 53,000 people or 53,000 tickets distributed in excess of that. But we do have a turnstile count number, and interesting to look at the percentage difference from the estimated number and how it compares to last year.
Yes, it's basically mathematically this makes sense. Here we'll put this article from WrestleNomics.com on the screen here. We have a turnstile count. So what is a turnstile count? Does everyone at home know what a turnstile count is? You have your scorecards ready. A turnstile count is the number of tickets. This is according to the local government, of course, the number of tickets that they recorded as scanned, or however you at Wembley Stadium, you can tell me how they were counting those tickets and how they were counting admission, which does leave some space for people, including Tony Khan has raised this to say there might be people who've gotten the stadium without their tickets being scanned by some form or another. Okay. That's possible. So this turnstile count for this year's event is, you ready? Drum roll, 46,476 people. That's how many tickets were scanned and used for admission. Again, maybe others got in by hopping over the fence, by going in the door for the suites. Who knows? Last year's turnstile count was 72,265. That's about 36% down difference, right? So I was pointing that out, not to say, they're down by that much, but to say, let's see if this is consistent. The announced paid attendance, of course, last year, according to AEW itself, 81,035. Tony Khan tweeted, here's the tweet. He tweeted last week on the 27th. Maybe that's 2 weeks ago. Anyway, he tweeted on the 27th, over 50K tickets sold. Okay. And I don't know. I could do the math. And if I want to make these percentages consistent, it gets to like 52,000. Obviously that's believable. And then we know that WrestleTix has told me that there's not been a final estimate yet, but the most recent estimate is 53,393 for this year's event, down from 131, and that's down 36%. These numbers all make sense, is the point here. There were at least 46,000 people in the building, big crowd. What more is there to say here? It is surprising, right, that you've got some 13%, maybe some 15%, something like that. In this case, it's about 87%. Only 87% of the tickets that were estimated to be distributed were actually used. What's happening here? If you look at the report that I did, I'm sure everyone's looking at it this afternoon, the report that I did for AEW Revolution, which was in Greensboro Coliseum, is a government building, luckily, and we got all the records, and we do have a drop count, a turnstile count, whatever you want to call it, for AEW Revolution. And that was 16,000. That was 13,950. The number of tickets that were distributed, the sales plus the comps, was 16,118. as everyone knows, that's 87%, and that lines up really well with the percentage of tickets used versus tickets distributed in this case.
The biggest question, though, is that if Brandon Thurston were to get a tattoo to mark All In 2024, what would be the number to get inked onto your arm?
Well, I think this is a perfect opportunity for AEW to release the ticket audits for All In 2023 and All In 2024. So we can have better assurance of what numbers we should, in fact, get tattooed on our skin.
Okay, so it remains to be seen what would be the official number, but there you go. AEW, rest in peace, right? That's the conclusion everyone has drawn.
Well, Labor Day was Monday, okay? And you told me yourself that AEW is, I think the indication that you gave, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but I think you said that AEW is basically dead if we don't have a TV deal announced by Labor Day.
Until Dynamite goes on the air tonight, I mean, who knows, right?
Like, who knows?
What could be, what could this mean? What are the tea leaves stating, Brandon? Yes, we continue to go without this TV deal. And we await the announcement. I more so am more just guessing how they're going to make this announcement. Like, I hope they have some grand rollout. Like, who's going to get this one? Is this John Orand level for an AEW TV deal? Is this going to be, is Barstool going to get it? I mean, is it going to be, some means of distribution that we're not even thinking about yet?
You're talking about announcing other than a press release, which I'm sure they will announce in a press release form, when there is a new deal and who it's with. But as far as the dollar value or any other details about the terms,
you think the first announcement of it will be a press release from the company? That'll be the first indication of a new deal from the company itself.
Maybe. I don't know. This isn't a publicly held company. We saw WWE announce Netflix on their own first, right? So I would guess so, but who knows?
Well, that's the never ending story in professional wrestling is, not a whole lot on the TV front, but we are past Labor Day. So now all eyes are on what? Halloween? What's the next big marker that we can place in the sand? Arthur Ashe Stadium.
New Year's Eve. It'll expire around then. So I hopefully hope there's
maybe they'll redo the announcement of AEW, which they did on that Being the Elite on New Year's Eve. Maybe that's where they'll do it, right in front of the Tokyo Dome on their phones. Mm-hmm. And we'll get a WBD logo.
Yeah, I think, you know, if AEW wanted to make an argument that, hey, look, we're actually very pro labor. In fact, we have launched an informal pension system to help wrestlers have podcasts that continue to support their incomes later in life. You could, and that's why we haven't announced a TV deal, in fact, to create more content for our wrestling legends of the world.
Let's move on to the Mr. McMahon series, which is dropping at the end of September. 6-episode series. Since we last spoke with you a week ago, we have learned several new things over the production of this series. Now, back in 2020, when Nick Khan broke the news that Netflix was going to be airing a documentary series on Vince McMahon, who was then their chairman in 2020, and that Bill Simmons and Chris Smith would be leading the production with WWE Studios involved. And then curiously, WWE Studios and WWE omitted from the mentions last week when Netflix put out the premiere date. And you and I have since confirmed that WWE will not have any producing credits on this documentary. Cody Rhodes alluded to this after in the Bash in Berlin press conference when he was asked about the series. And does that, I mean, they will not have a producing credit in this. And Simmons had stated in the past that they would have final cut on this series regardless. But that is not to say that there will not be WWE involvement in this when it comes to various people interviewed for this, as well as footage that naturally you're going to see in the series.
Yeah, we're keeping an open mind about the fairness about what this documentary is going to have. That being said, there are some conflicts of interest inevitably. I mean, this is Netflix that just signed a huge media deal with WWE. They're now WWE's leading business partner, and that'll go into effect in the new year. They're going to be carrying Raw. They're going to be carrying, broadly carrying international rights around the world. And that's a really important business relationship. So whether or not it's Nick Khan picking up the phone and telling, Reed Hastings or who's the other one to change the Netflix documentary, there might just be some unconscious pressures or, it's just some pressures to tell a better story or a nicer story for WWE. That being said, we do know, as you said, that WWE ended up not having a production credit. We're trying to learn some more details about what the content is of this six episode docuseries, 1 hour each. But we learned also that Janelle Grant, is not interviewed for this documentary. She was approached to be interviewed. There were discussions about potentially having her be included in this documentary, but ultimately she was not a part of this documentary. We have that according to a spokesperson for Janelle Grant, who told us Netflix's documentary group made initial outreach to Janelle's representation for an interview for this project. Despite this, no such interview came to fruition. And go ahead.
And just to add to that, I mean, the fact that as well that not Janelle nor anyone attached with Janelle is going to be interviewed. So that would mean, like, when you're thinking people representing Janelle Grant, you would think of Ann Callis. So for a lot of people that were just responding with, well, of course not, it's an ongoing lawsuit or investigation. Like, we've had Ann Callis on our show. It's like, I don't think that would have been the reason to not participate just because there's an active lawsuit.
Right. Certainly with legal advice, you can say certain things about matters that are related to ongoing legal situations. And we did ask Library Films, which is the producer of this. Chris Smith is the co-executive producer along with Bill Simmons. We reached out to Library Films. We didn't receive a response, but we did get a response from a source with knowledge of the production who said that Grant was approached to participate in the series multiple times, but ultimately decided not to, according to that source. So that's what we know. There's not going to be a Janelle Grant interview in here, but I do expect that there's going to be some coverage in this documentary of the situation involving her lawsuit and her allegations.
It would be impossible not to. And I think beyond just since the filming of this documentary right at the end, and it's just like a text of a lawsuit was filed, like, for them not to address Janelle Grant, to me, it disqualifies the entire series. Like, it will be written off by people if there isn't some level of coverage of the Janelle Grant suit, or I think it'll really handicap people's interest in this documentary, period. And I brought this question up last week. It's not as though we're going to have a clear answer until we see it, but I'm very curious to see what level of mention, if any, WWE will have of this documentary. It's not as though this is happening on some separate service that they don't have a relationship with. Like, if I'm Netflix, the number one avenue I want to promote this for is through WWE. And if I can't maximum promotion of this, this wouldn't be the time I'd be releasing the documentary either. So I'm very curious. And, we can go back to Saturday, the Bash in Berlin press conference, and a reporter there did ask Cody Rhodes, who was semi sitting in for Paul Levesque. He read off the business notes for the show and was asked about this documentary series, as well as Janelle Grant, if he believes the allegations. And Cody did bring up that he believed WWE was not involved with this with this documentary series. And I don't know if that's Cody just being savvy and being up, having his WrestleNomics and post-wrestling news coming onto his phone, because I doubt he was prepped for anything related to this going into that press conference. I'd be surprised if he was. And if so, I thought he responded as well as he could on his feet to a question that I don't know if your Cody Rhodes are necessarily expecting to field all these months in.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one thing we've learned from all of the interviews and public appearances that Cody Rhodes has done, is he is a effective politician. I think it's something that AEW has lost too since he's left. But I think he did about as well as you could do without taking any real position here, right? He wasn't saying that he was. He was asked directly, "Do you believe Janelle Grant?" That was pretty much
with a follow up, like twice, like the you did have the reporter's name, and credit for him for asking and then re-asking the question at the end, because Cody did not answer the question at first.
Yes, I'll try to find the reporter's name while we're talking here. But it's sort of coincidental what we're having a discussion with Neil Flanagan last week about, you know, the degree to which it's hard to make follow-up questions. Granted, we were talking about an AEW press conference in that context. But the initial question was, say, there's this documentary happening. There hasn't been much comment. I believe he used the word side. There was silence from the talent in the locker room about whether or not they believe Janelle Grant, et cetera. And Cody gave this sort of thoughtful, nice answer, without saying too much about what he believes. He talked about whether he's going to watch the documentary. He talked about Game of Thrones. But he talked about, you know, hopefully there's justice, whatever it might be. And he was asked in a follow-up question where presumably by the sounds of it, the reporters wasn't near the microphone anymore at that point, but did, say a question, uttered a question that, Cody had trouble hearing, and they did bring the microphone back to him. And he clearly asked, do you believe Janelle Grant? And Cody said that something to the effect of, sorry, I just don't know enough information to say. Who knows what kind of abuse that reporter got, for his question, but, it's good to see that Tilo Jung is the person. So not a regular member of the wrestling media. I understand he's some sort of influencer. Let's see, some sort of,
he works for an outlet IVV, there's a pretty sizable following here, as I'm just looking at his account here, followed by John Cena and Charlotte Flair, by the way.
I think John Cena follows me too, so
yeah, he follows all of us. Did you feel that was was he in a position where, like, you're kind of sitting in for Paul Levesque, like that was a relevant question for a Cody Rhodes to answer?
I'm not urging people to ask talent about this. I don't think most talent are in a safe enough position to be honest. And I think you could kind of read from Cody's response, that maybe that's part of what he was getting at, and that, to the question of why have talent not said very much at all about the Janelle Grant allegations, is that I think not many of them feel safe to say much. Now, Cody's on the high end of people who should feel more safe because he is in such a high and important position. He's one of the biggest stars. WWE's relying more on him than they are relying on people further down the card. So he is probably in a more safe situation here to speak more freely. And Paul Levesque was not there. I understand Paul Levesque was taking care of helping one of his daughters go to college. Is it appropriate to ask him? I think it's okay to ask him that. And he has commented on this before. He did. He took a question about it at the Royal Rumble, memorably.
All right. We don't have too much to say on the Odyssey Jones front, but I know both of us were looking into this this week. So last Monday, he was off Raw, and it wasn't really, people missed shows. It's not a giant cause of concern. But then over the weekend, I heard it through Mr. Thurston here on top of the WWE website profiles that Odyssey Jones profile had been removed from the WWE site. I did reach out to WWE. They have not responded about this. Fightful has since reported, and he missed Raw again this past Monday, and it was a much more notable absence because the story had been out all day, and if it was much ado about nothing, WWE easily could have just simply stated as such. There was silence all day, and then he's not on Raw, and Fightful has since reported that some past issues involving domestic violence, I guess, had come to their attention. That's what Fightful has reported. And we believe he is done with the company, but WWE has not commented yet on the record in any capacity about his status. So that's about what we know regarding Odyssey Jones.
Yeah. And I've looked, I tried to find any arrest records related to his legal name. I could not find any. That doesn't mean that something didn't happen. This doesn't mean that there weren't domestic violence issues related to him, but no arrest records in the jurisdictions that I was looking for that I thought were most likely to have them.
Coming up this weekend, AEW is back in Chicago for two nights at the Now Arena. We have a Collision/Rampage taping on Friday night. They're going 3 hours straight on TNT, so they will be going head to head with the final SmackDown on Fox on Friday night, and then following it with the pay-per-view on Saturday night, with 2,315 tickets out for Friday's show and just over 6,500 tickets out as of the last check from WrestleTix as they go into their second year in a row where All Out is coming in quick succession after the All In show, although they did give an extra week of buffer time this year.
Yes, and this is a landmark, the end of the Fox relationship for WWE.
It's coming to an end after 5 years, from Brock Lesnar versus Kofi Kingston on episode one to however they close out the Fox run. How do you look at this period? Like the 5 years, there was a lot of curiosity of WWE going to, for the first time, regular appearances on one of the big four networks. I don't think people quite had a UPN in that echelon of networks, nor did they view CW. But these 5 years, do you feel like, how do you look at WWE's handling of their time on Fox? And it did coincide with like a major boom in company business, but I don't know how much of that's going to be attributed to Fox. Although we did see crossover, we saw a lot of, you know, interesting dynamics between Fox and WWE over these 5 years.
Yeah, it's an underrated story that this relationship apparently didn't work out. We saw a lot of shoulder programming at first on Fox when WWE first debuted SmackDown there, had a huge rating to start. We saw, what was it, Backstage? You can remind me of what the other titles were. And those quickly went away.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, you know.
Yeah, that was the FS1 show that officially brought CM Punk back to professional wrestling.
And I remember asking around at the time that there were, I don't know, rumors that, you know, maybe there was some discomfort between WWE and Fox. And I was always told that, no, everything is fine. I mean, there clearly must have been some disappointment given that they didn't bid very aggressively to keep SmackDown. And I think it was just probably a matter of not being able to monetize, for one thing, not being able to monetize SmackDown in the way that they must have hoped. You know, we got reports from, I believe it was it The Hollywood Reporter in 2018 about how these negotiations, you know, came about with NBC renewing Raw in 2018 and letting SmackDown go to the open market, and Fox picking it up, with Rupert Murdoch reportedly saying that they're ashamed of you referring to NBCU and saying that we will actually embrace you because we're not going to be you know, bothered by any sort of stigma that's around wrestling. Well, apparently they weren't able to, you know, get the ad revenue out of it that they hoped, or they weren't able to get the carriage rights value out of it that they hoped, despite Fox being over the air. It is part of the carriage rights that they sell along with their other networks, including FS1 and whatever else is left in the Fox News, of course, in the bucket of Fox networks. So it apparently didn't work out as well as they had hoped. Despite in 2021, 2022, I guess it would really have started about two thirds of the way through this relationship. Ratings improved despite cord cutting. Somehow ratings improved and the popularity of WWE really increased. And you saw a lot of rating success around the Roman Reigns bloodline storyline, things like that.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, it's your chance to travel back to November 2004 as Wei Ting and I review WWE Raw, featuring Trish Stratus and Lita headlining the show. Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson are going to be covering New Japan's Destruction in Kobe event, and MCU Later tackles Agatha All Along. All of that, plus Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course weekly, and ad-free versions of Rewind to Raw and Dynamite. $6 a month unlocks it all at postwrestlingcafe.com.
What would you say to the person that would look at, okay, you're explaining here that SmackDown, for the successes it brought, and Fox, you know, many, many nights winning Fridays with SmackDown, ultimately
practically every night. Like, I was, like, the vast majority of nights in the demo, number one.
Like, it was a routine winner for the company, but they felt the price was too steep. And yet the lesson of this is that they're going to USA for more money per year. How does this make sense? And is this almost a, like, an overview of just where the television industry is at the moment, where you will pay for loss leaders?
I guess.
Like, can USA have any better success than Fox did, paying more for SmackDown than Fox was?
In the case of USA, it's probably contributing a lot more to their percentage of carriage rights, right? So USA is going to lose Raw. If they lose WWE altogether, I think they have a lot more trouble justifying their carriage fee, which is, I don't have it in front of me, but it's not zero, right? It's something. Does Fox need WWE to justify a carriage fee while Fox is carrying the NFL, and carrying college football? What else do they have? Baseball. I don't know that that adds very much to their carriage fee by having SmackDown, despite the fact SmackDown's year round, you got it all 52 weeks of the year. I don't know that it hits a lot of, open spots that are, you know, open needs for value in the Fox world as opposed to USA, which, you know, what's by far the most watched content on USA? It's WWE, maybe Premier League is in there too, but it's by far Raw. And if Raw is going to go to Netflix, it would really help them to sustain their carriage fee value if they do have 2 hours of live premium content, highly viewed content, which SmackDown will continue to be.
What do you feel is the, like, they will move to SmackDown September 13th, which is a week from Friday. A month from now, do you have like a guesstimate of what SmackDown settled at on USA? Too hard to guess at this point of what they're going to retain of the 2 to 2.2 million that they're doing on Friday on Fox when you move that same night, same time, but a less available network in USA.
It's probably going to do like a weak Raw rating, and Raw right now is doing anywhere between 1.6 and 1.8 million viewers. So I think it's going to be on the low end, maybe slightly below that. So maybe 1.5, 1.4 million on a weaker night, which is Friday. And if by all indications, this is continuing on Friday, all these nights are staying the same for all of these programs, right? Which tells us, you know, that dictates what the open nights are for the rest of the wrestling world. So that tells you Dynamite's probably staying on Wednesday. Not so sure about the others, but you know, the best nights are accounted for.
And I do read that as a win for WWE, because I think it would have been their prerogative to stay on Fridays for the simple fact of more and more opportunities to go overseas to sell these shows. And as we're seeing in Saudi Arabia, tacking on SmackDown, or in the case of November, tacking on Raw, I think they like having that Friday show, and we can do back-to-back nights. We can pair up with UFC, but having those weekend events, I think that's to their benefit. Like, we're getting a raise on SmackDown, and we can sell these shows overseas multiple times per year, as opposed to moving SmackDown to a night of the week that might be more advantageous for USA.
And you would think that there would be a lot of flexibility there, considering how important WWE, considering how important SmackDown will be for the USA Network versus all they got to do is shuffle around some NCIS or Law and Order reruns, or in the case of Netflix, where you have no live weekly schedule other than Raw. So there's that. We do have a question here from one Jumanji Hunter.
John, you mentioned that Netflix might be better than broadcast in 5 years on Rewind to Raw. Do you agree, Brandon? I have doubts about the stream success. So the question I was asked was, would you rather be on broadcast television or Netflix? And my answer was that if you're asking me just today and I have a 1 year deal, I'd want to be on broadcast. But yeah, 5 years from now, Netflix is where I would want to be planting the seeds and the growth opportunity for Netflix.
I would probably agree. So cable is probably getting under 70 million homes. Netflix is probably getting close to that and maybe has already surpassed the major cable networks in terms of the household reach. Broadcast would be somewhere above that still, but still on the decline. The only questions I have is, are people going to watch live content on a service such as Netflix? We don't have a lot of experiments testing that.
Not watch the hot doggy?
No, I have not watched the Kobayashi versus, who is it?
Joey Chestnut.
Yes.
No. Apparently won.
But what's the numbers for that? What was the viewership for that live same day? What was it?
Oh, it was, you know what? It's, I'm sure we'll get a mysterious tweet, at some point. Yeah. We have no Vibes. That's the answer.
It's happening. And there's going to be that's going to be a Mike Tyson fight at some point with Jake Paul.
November. Yep.
But are we going to have Nielsen measurements of that? Are we going to know, did that do 1 million viewers, 2 million viewers? I don't know.
Yeah. Unfortunately, at least you will still have some transparency, because here in my Canadian ratings are about to go extinct at the end of this year.
That's right. All of it's going to Netflix.
Everything is going to Netflix, including the network. So we are going to be, in some ways, for a wrestling fan in Canada, it's like, it's one place to go for everything, which might ease up your cable bill.
So also, Netflix is getting a Christmas Day NFL game.
Yes.
The one reliable standard so far in the world of Nielsen measurement has been NFL games. I don't think there's been an NFL game in recent history, right, that hasn't had the traditional Nielsen average minute audience measurement. Does that mean if there's not a Nielsen measurement for that Netflix game, then I would really lose some hope that we're ever going to, or at any time soon, we're going to get raw ratings from Nielsen. But if there is, it doesn't hurt hope. We'll see.
It also won't hurt that with all that focus on Netflix on Christmas Day, you would imagine the built-in ads for the Raw debut, yeah, which they have stated January 6th, which I think everyone has assumed would be the first Monday of January. But that's going to be a nice boost, because you would have to think for a lot of people that are sampling that Christmas Day game that they're going to be heavily invested in promoting Raw's pending debut.
Yeah. Speaking of TV schedules, do we know that Dynamite going to be preempted again for the Major League Baseball playoffs in October?
I was actually looking at the upcoming shows. I do not know of any movement yet. But that's a good question. They have Dynamite scheduled for every Wednesday, but if any of them get bumped to other networks.
So say the second week of October, is there a Dynamite live event scheduled for a Wednesday already? I'm working on looking here.
So we have October the 3rd. Sorry, October the 2nd is the 5-year anniversary show. And then they are doing Title Tuesday on October 8th. So that week they are moving to Tuesday. That's the head to head night with NXT and St. Louis. Yes.
Yes. So that's what I was getting at, is that there's going to be an NXT head to head with Dynamite, second week of NXT on the CW.
Yeah. Which, I'm very curious to see what NXT does, especially its first week on CW, where you have CM Punk, you're building up Julia's title challenge on that show, and I'm sure they're going to load it up with main roster stars, and to see what they can hit on CW. As well.
Only 5,000 tickets out for that, according to WrestleTix, that Rosemont Horizon Allstate Arena October 1st debut. So clearly, I mean, like, if this was a Raw or a SmackDown, I guess we could look at Raws and SmackDowns around it, right? Let's go further. I guess we only have about 5,000 out in Greenville, South Carolina for SmackDown. Maybe it'll climb up there, but it's certainly not like NXT is being treated like a pay-per-view. We'll see how much they're able to fill that up.
Monday Night Football as well is back this Monday, so take that into account as we are back into NFL season. So we're going to look forward to whatever discourse comes out of these changes in the seasonal calendar.
Probably the last 10% hit is usually what it does to Raw.
Is it the New York Jets playing on Monday? Is this are they up against Aaron Rodgers? I think so.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's a guess on my part. The final thing, one of our favorite people, Mark Shapiro. He was on Andrew Marchand's podcast last week. I believe
Jets
this
and 49ers.
Jets and 49ers. There you go. NFL genius, John Pollock here. So Mark Shapiro was on. He spoke about the Netflix deal with WWE, but I want to play a clip where he was asked about the UFC rights and how he sees things. Guess what? He's very optimistic about how things are going to play out for Dana White and company.
There's no shortage of demand of platforms that have all even casually mentioned to us their interest. Pay-per-view is the monthly pay-per-views we have are as premium as you're ever going to find, similar to the PLEs with WWE. This is what youth is watching, men and women. This is what college-age students are watching. This is appointment viewing for anyone 18 to 34. And this is only going to get bigger. Dana White himself is the best brand in sports. Let's be clear about that. UFC has become one of the best brands in sports. They've got a big platform, big reach, big audience, super engagement. Now advertisers and sponsors flocking to it. Cities paying us from around the globe to bring our events, not just the pay-per-views. Mm. We're just talking the fight nights, the weekly fight nights to the cities and paying us big sums to do it. And there's no better marketer, none, than the ESPN machine underneath the Disney umbrella. None. What they've done for the reach of our brand, for the ratings of our events, for the pay-per-view sales, for the way that we've developed stars, I'm not sure anybody else could have done that. We're now at an inflection point. Is there more we can do with them? Or is it now time to split the package or go in a different direction? We'll see what the market will bear. But we love ESPN Disney.
Love them. And he did this hour-long interview standing up as only Mark Pirro could, and very optimistic. The best brand in all of sports, Dana White.
He appears to be standing up perhaps in a hallway somewhere at Endeavor headquarters.
It did kind of feel like he's waiting for this elevator and just decided to do a FaceTime call for an hour with Andrew Marchand. But yeah, I mean, number one, I mean, really focusing on that 18 to 34 demo, Brandon. Maybe, you know, forget those plus 34s. We're going younger and younger. And yeah, I don't doubt any of his sincerity in terms of the amount of interest that are going to be in these UFC rights, because even Jimmy Pitaro this past week was speaking about the fact that, listen, everything is locked up except for UFC. Like, everyone is focused on UFC, because this is, for sports media, this is just like, you're just devouring like the next sports rights to debate upon and where it's going to go. And UFC is going to be the focus of everyone next year of who lands. And I think they're going to have many, many different suitors.
And WBD just lost the NBA, and maybe they've got some extra cash to burn in addition to what they've already burned.
We will see what Mr. Zaslav has to say. And the last thing here, this is really not connected to the last thing, but Dana White on Tuesday night, he has a warning for all you people pirating UFC papers.
Trust me, we know exactly how to combat piracy. I won't tell you extensively what we do every event, but we go after piracy hard. And you saw a few years ago, we started prosecuting people. That's how you combat piracy. Start fucking prosecuting people for stealing. There you go.
The best brand in sports. Dana White, don't steal my pay-per-views or we're going to come and prosecute you. So I think that that puts a bow on today's show, bookending it with legal threats.
Yes, we reported the other week on they're suing a barbershop / bar. And I was just looking up the lawsuits, the various lawsuits that Zuffa is a plaintiff in. And it looks like that was just a routine lawsuit. What I'm guessing they're doing is they're perusing social media for restaurants and bars and establishments that are advertising. They're having the audacity to advertise that they have UFC while not having a commercial license to play the pay-per-view. And they have no hesitation. I'm sure very much in line with Dana White's sentiment in that clip. They have no hesitation to file a lawsuit against you if you're doing that.
Yeah. And this came in response to a question, because Turki Alshik
is his name. Yes,
Turki Alshik. He had stated that he feels boxing pay-per-views, they should be moving them down to $15 to $20 per pay-per-view. This will combat piracy in the sense that they're just too expensive. And if we lower the price, all of these people that are getting these shows for free will somehow decide out of the goodness of their heart to spend $15 or $20. I don't think that's quite a premise that will play itself out, but I don't think he is hurting for pay-per-view revenue in the amount that they're spending.
Did you hear that Turki Alshik was tweeting that he just got off the phone with Oscar De La Hoya, with the Golden Boy himself, and they had agreed that he's going to play some fight on television for free. So please kindly reach out to him and we will discuss distribution. Is something that he tweeted the other day.
Okay, well, there you go, man. That's very transparent in his business dealings on X that you can always follow. All right, that's going to wrap up the show. We crammed a lot into this hour. Were you energized at this earlier start time? Is this going to be an adjustment period for you, Brandon, as you accommodate my crazy schedule?
I think it'll be fine. I don't know. What do the listeners think?
You let us know, folks. Let us know how this new start time works for you. And I can't say we can really move it. We're our hands are kind of tied, but enjoy this as always. Brandon is back this coming Sunday behind the WrestleNomics Patreon, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. So tune into that Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern time. I'm back tonight with Wei Ting as we are chatting Dynamite minutes after the show goes off the air. So hit the subscribe button here on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. And then we're going on Rewind Away Thursday on the Post Wrestling Cafe to Beast from the East, a WWE Network special that aired live at 5:30 a.m. Eastern in the morning back in July of 2015.
Yeah, I remember watching that and feeling like, for one thing, I felt like I was, because of the time, I felt like I was watching Japanese wrestling. You know, it was that Japanese wrestling watching mindset of being up at like 5 a.m. local time here. But also I had the sense that, like, just watching the production of that show, that like, oh, Vince isn't overseeing this. I felt like the production was very different. Michael Cole's commentary was much freer than usual. It's like, oh,
Michael Cole is the legacy of that show. Like, it's a totally different Michael Cole in 2005. It's the Michael Cole you get now without the restraints. It's him and Byron Saxton at headquarters on a Saturday morning at 5 a.m. when Vince had probably just finished up his workout routine and had slept for 2 hours during the show.
Yes. Yes. His only 2 hours that he would be sleeping that day, but yes.
All right. That's going to wrap things up. As Fallen Footwear states, earlier time, much better. So we appreciate the feedback, everyone. We're back here next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Set your alarm now so that it goes off, and we will speak with you in 7 days.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.